This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Antek. Each year, 5 to 10,000 Nepali girls are trafficked into the brothels of India. Only 1% of these sex slaves ever escape or get rescued. The rest succumb to murder, suicide, or slowly from diseases like HIV/AIDS. Grant Nicely joins us today to talk about sexual slavery in Nepal. His most recent documentary is Untouchable, Children of God. Grant, welcome.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having us on the program.
Let's begin with, how did you came across this story?
About 2.5 years ago, a friend of mine from Sweden was passing through Singapore. And I spent the past 10 years living in Singapore. And he shared the story of two young girls from Nepal who were deceived, drugged, and sold to a brothel in India. And what made it even worse is that they were sold by their relatives, either cousins or aunts. And this was really the door that opened to the magnitude of the issue of human trafficking and modern-day slavery. I'd never heard stories like that before. So the story of these two girls who were sold from Nepal to the brothel in India was really the catalyst that sparked my interest and attention in probably one of the greatest human rights issues of our time.
You subtitled the film Children of God. Is there a reason behind that?
There is. So the two girls that we focus primarily on in the film are part of the untouchable caste, the Dalits in India and the Badi of Nepal. The untouchables have been called many things over the past several decades and even centuries in Nepal and India. And it was actually Gandhi in India who renamed the untouchables as Harijans, which also can be interpreted as children of God. So he was trying to, fight an uphill battle. The caste system, which has been in place for a long time in India, is really quite an oppressive and dehumanizing system. So the untouchables are not even viewed as human beings. A cow is treated better than a human being if it's an untouchable in India. So it was really Gandhi that was trying to paint them in a better light and give them, some humanity and dignity and try to break that social curse by renaming them.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the story of the two Nepali girls that you focus in your film. How did you decide where to start or who to talk to or even who to approach at the beginning?
So once my friend from Sweden had shared those two stories about the girls, we set about making several phone calls and really just seeing what doors would open. Especially with documentary filmmaking, you can do all the planning you want, but at the end of the day, things change constantly. So we really started with the girls as kind of the backbone of the story, and we wanted to meet their families and speak with their counselors. They were in a safe home in Kathmandu and had only been rescued, really not even 1 year, the first time we met them, from the brothel in India. So these girls were quite young. They were still quite traumatized, and, our mission with Code Red Films, Taking Risks to Tell the Truth, which is the nonprofit that I started last year, is really to provide a platform, for those people or people groups who don't really have a voice in their own society. So through our interpreters and the counselor, we spoke to the girls and wanted to make sure they felt comfortable. And if they wanted to share their story, we would provide a platform for them to do that. But they only would share what they wanted to. It wasn't a question and answer interview. It was really, we'll record whatever you want to say. And these two girls are really quite courageous and brave, and they do represent the 1% who ever escape or get rescued, those who are sold into slavery in the brothels. So we really, we're quite amazed at their courage and boldness to speak out on behalf of all their sisters and these other girls who were still enslaved.
Were other prostitutes open to talking to you besides these two girls?
Yeah, so the two girls were sold to a brothel on GB Road in New Delhi in India. But we wanted to expand the scope of the film to really include at least one other major city in India, which was Mumbai. So we went to Kamathapura, which is one of the largest red light areas in all of Asia. It was really originally set up by the British, but still flourishes today. So we did make a few local contacts, both in India and Nepal, several full-time workers as well as volunteers in the areas of prevention, intervention, those who did actual raids in the brothels in conjunction with some of the police. So we worked with them, and it was really reliant on them, you know, to get some of those interviews with women and girls who were still active prostitutes or who had escaped that lifestyle.
There were referenced in the film that these are highly profitable operations that run by gangs and mafias and even have the complicities of authorities and police. Were you at any time harassed by the authorities during the filming process?
Personally, I was not, nor any member of our film crew. We were extremely fortunate. It is a very dangerous business. You know, human trafficking is now the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the world behind drug trafficking. And the latest estimate is that it generates about $150 billion U.S. dollars a year. One of the major issues in India is the corruption. So we met a girl in Mumbai who was only 16, forced into prostitution. 100% of her customers were politicians and police officers. So when you have corruption all the way at the top, and those who are supposed to be enforcing, you know, the laws are actually some of the perpetrators and even owners in conjunction with the brothels, there's not much hope of justice. So it's very difficult to kind of navigate. You know, you can't even trust half of the police in India. So we had to be very wise and discerning and cautious about where we filmed and also what areas we went into.
The Badi people used to be a proud people who performed for royalties, according to your film. Tell us about the tribe. How did they find themselves in their current predicament?
The Badi of Nepal is an ethnic group that's been around for decades in Nepal, and originally from India. And they used to correct the entertainers for a lot of the Rajas and royalty in India. But over time, that really degenerated, and they became a kind of hereditary prostitute community because all of their skills, singing, dancing, making instruments, entertaining, that kind of gave way to modern technology of music and television and other forms of entertainment. So eventually, really due to extreme poverty as well as, you know, social stigma in the caste system, they were kind of forced into this lifestyle where they sell their daughters. And it's become very common in rural Nepal where even fathers would sell one of their daughters just so they can feed the other seven or eight children. And I don't know to what extent they realize what happens to them in the brothels of India. Some are under the impression they're going to get jobs, you know, different employment in these big cities. They don't realize necessarily they're being sold into a brothel and the torture and abuse and exploitation that goes on. So the Badi, they've made progress recently in Nepal in recent years and have been recognized by the government, and there is some funding. Previously, they had very few rights. They couldn't own land. They were discriminated against in a variety of ways. So it has gotten better and progressed over time, but it's been a long, difficult struggle. And many of the Badi still live in caves or in extreme poverty in rural Nepal.
Right, about the men. What do they do for a living?
So at least in the few Badi villages that we visited in far western Nepal, some of the men are fishermen in rivers or lakes. Others do still craft the models, the drums or sarangi, some of the instruments that they play. But I think what we observed is that it's really kind of perpetuated this culture where the men over time become very lazy, and because they can sell their daughters or it becomes so open and accepted, because of the untouchable caste, that, you know, the women will go into this profession of prostitution, that they've just kind of accepted it. But not all of the men. There are several that have been advocating for change and trying to step forward to improve, you know, their position in Nepal.
On the program today is Grant Nicely. He is the director of Untouchable. We'll get his thoughts on the larger problem of rape and sexual crimes in India after the break. BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. If you've just joined us, we are speaking to Grant Nicely today about sexual slavery in Nepal and India, which is the subject of his latest documentary, untouchable children of God. Before we left off, you were saying how fathers and mothers of daughters sell them into sex trades, sometimes knowingly, sometimes unknowingly. But of those who made it back, the 1% that you mentioned who managed to escape, aren't they providing testimonials or cautionary tale about what happens to women who go into India?
It's an excellent question. So one thing we observed, and this goes back to the culture and the social stigma in Nepal, it's very difficult for these women to return to Nepal. Many of them are HIV positive or have other sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, so even the government of Nepal prevents them from coming back. But say they're even HIV negative and they do find their way back to Nepal, a lot of the villages and the families will really ostracize them because of what they've been through, whether it was their fault or not in terms of being abducted and sold, or even if they went on their own accord and somehow got trafficked to a brothel. So it's a very difficult journey. The two girls in our film, because they were still quite young, 14, 15 years old when they came back, one of the girls, she just has a mother and doesn't have much of a family beyond that. But the other girl, her father and sisters and siblings were very welcoming, you know, her back into the family, even though she shared the abuse and exploitation that she endured in the brothels.
Does this frustrate you? How do you communicate this concept to a Western audience?
And that's a great point because, you know, as an American, even though I lived in Asia and Singapore for 10 years, I think in Western and certainly American culture and society, you know, a child could do the worst thing imaginable. And I think any parent here would still welcome them back, you know, and there may be discipline involved, but ultimately you forgive and welcome back into the family. So it's quite eye-opening for me traveling in Nepal and India to see how many of these girls and women are just completely and utterly rejected by their family and village and community based on something that happened that wasn't even their fault. They might have been a victim in the entire process. So it's very difficult, and it's been a learning journey, an eye-opening process, the magnitude of modern-day slavery. I didn't realize how young some of these girls were and the sheer volume. You know, they estimate 10 to 20,000 girls every year are trafficked intentionally across the border from Nepal to India into the brothels as sex slaves. So it's a growing problem, and they estimate now there's 30 million slaves in the world, 70% in Asia, and one-third based in India. And that's the majority are women and children. Unlike the transatlantic slave trade, where it was mostly men from Africa to America for labor, now it's women and children for sex slavery instead of labor. So it's changed dramatically, and the problem's getting worse every day.
Some of these facts have been trickling into the mainstream media since the high-profile cases of gang rape in Delhi and Mumbai. Has it affected the national conversation at all, you think, in India about crimes against sexual crimes, particularly against women in India?
I think it has. It started to, and that's a great thing. It needs to be a spark or catalyst for change, especially within Indian society and culture. One of the interviews in our film, a gentleman who's a close friend of mine, him and his wife and daughter live in Delhi, and they do a lot of outreach to girls on the streets who are susceptible to be trafficked, as well as outreach to men who are paying for sex in the red light areas of Delhi. And after you referenced the gang rape case in South Delhi with a girl, as you know, actually was life flighted to Singapore, and that's where she died days after she had been violently gang raped in Delhi. And Abhishek Gere, who is based in Delhi, he said he was driving along and saw a big holding, a billboard or sign on the freeway that said, "She is dead, but she woke up the nation." And I'd like to hope that that is true, that the nation of India is waking up to the reality of the magnitude of these violent crimes against women and children, and hopefully taking proactive steps, you know, starting with the government and prime minister all the way down to local law enforcement with the police officers and ensuring there's no corruption and that justice is served. So it's a really important issue, and I think because that was a high-profile media case, it is a step in the right direction. You know, people need to be educated and aware of an issue before they can take action to try to create some positive change.
about the attention, how much do you think it's because of caste difference? Because the victims are from a higher caste and the rapists were migrant workers and they are from a lower caste. Would it have created much of a stir if it was the other way around?
I think there's definitely a difference if the victim is from a lower caste and certainly the untouchable caste, because still my observation, just based on limited trips to India and Nepal, is that they are still practically, socially, you know, viewed as subhuman. So they would not get as much media attention. I mean, citizens would not care about the plight or crimes committed against, say, the untouchables, as they would certainly somebody from the middle class or upper class of Indian society. So I think there is a direct correlation between the amount of media attention and, you know, the caste and background of somebody who is a victim. It's the same in America. I mean, depending if it's a white victim or a black victim or other minorities and where you come from, it is portrayed differently in the media. Absolutely.
So a few of the convicted rapists received the death penalty, and I was wondering, what are your thoughts on capital punishment and whether it's helpful? This is a debate that your country is having as well.
Capital punishment, ultimately, I don't believe that we should be the judge of taking another life. We did not create ourselves or life, so I don't think we should be the one to snuff out a human life. In my opinion,
right.
I think there's a lot of options for detainment and rehabilitation, because at the end of the day, to have somebody even sit in prison for life and think about the crime that they committed may ultimately be more effective than the cost and potential repercussions of capital punishment. It's very interesting because every country has different laws and deals with crimes differently. Criminal justice system in India is, you know, very difficult to seek any sort of justice. As an example, as it relates to human trafficking, you know, some of these girls, even if they manage to escape or get rescued, and again, they've been through months or years of torture, rape, and abuse, and normally they're under threat of death for themselves and their family if they testify in court. So the brothel owners and the perpetrators, they have multiple lawyers. And in one case in Mumbai that we heard about, a girl goes in and, you know, she's terrified to even share what happens in a court of law. And you don't even know if the judge is being bribed. So because of corruption and because of the fear and intimidation tactics of a lot of the perpetrators and brothel owners, you know, it's very difficult to see any sort of justice, especially in a nation like India. And hopefully that'll change in the future.
This is certainly an important film, and I hope many, many people see it. It's also not your first trip to Nepal, because you have a previous film about Nepal as well. And one of the unintended consequences of your film might be the promotion of poverty porn or volunteer tourism, which may cause more harm than good. I was wondering what you thought about that and what you hope to achieve with your film.
I first went to Nepal in 2001. I've been there 5 times and 3 trips specifically to produce this film over the past 2 years. I love Nepal, everything about it, the culture, the people. And so it's very close to my heart when I heard the story of these young girls being sold and trafficked and, you know, subject to all kinds of abuse and exploitation. I was really moved with compassion to try to help or do whatever I can as an artist and a filmmaker to shine a light on the subject and draw people's attention to it, because it is urgent and it's life or death. We make a point to establish strong rapport and relationships with locals in any country that we go to. Any film produced by Code Red Films, you know, that's one of our goals, is to kind of be light as a feather and, you know, really learn and observe and then try to empower, you know, survivors for success. And that's really done by the people who live there full-time, long-term. So we've maintained good relationships with several aftercare facilities in Kathmandu, as well as Delhi and Mumbai, and then several people working in the areas of prevention, prosecution, and intervention. So I think that, you know, obviously I am an American citizen. I lived in Singapore 10 years, but now I'm back in the U.S. So I'm not going to be the one there long-term in the future. But if I can use my skills and talents, hopefully, to tell a compelling story and do that, you know, in a way that showcases the reality of the pain and the suffering and the poverty, but hopefully also highlights, you know, a ray of hope and some of the beauty that we see when we go to Nepal and India. So you do have to be careful. You know, it makes a world of difference if you come back a second time. I think a lot of people, volunteer tourism, where people go in just once to a country and then disappear and never come back. So that was really important to us. We made 3 trips to Nepal and India just for this film. And then I previously traveled there a few times myself.
You have said that truth is not profitable, which makes what you're doing all the more necessary and difficult. How do you fund your projects?
We pray a lot and look for some very generous donors. I was previously working for a private software company the past 4 years in Singapore, and then I quit my job at the end of last year and founded Code Red Films, taking risks to tell the truth, because that's what I feel very convicted and called to do. It's challenging. We actually raised about 50% of our budget through crowdfunding. Some of the major sites, Kickstarter and Indiegogo. We launched a campaign on Indiegogo for $50,000 and actually raised $53,000. So that was about half of our budget, and then the rest came from private donors, friends, families, mostly in Singapore and the United States. We also had some from Sweden and a few other countries. But it's a growing trending topic, for better or worse, human trafficking and modern-day slavery. So I think there's a lot of interest from abolitionists and activists to try to put a stop to, you know, this crime against humanity.
Where can listeners go to find out more about your project or even contribute to your future projects?
Sure. We have a dedicated Facebook page, which is just /untouchablemovie. The official site is just www.untouchablemovie.com. Again, that's untouchablemovie.com. And then you can also go to Code Red Films, and there's a place to donate online via PayPal or credit card. And we are 100% funded by the generosity of individuals. So whether it's through crowdfunding on Indiegogo or just generous abolitionists who want to help us try to eradicate trafficking and slavery, that's how we've been able to produce this film and get it done.
Grant, thank you very much for speaking to us.
You're welcome. Yep. Thank you very much. We're very excited to have our Malaysian premiere next week at the Freedom Film Festival, and it's a very appropriate festival, you know, focused on human rights, and I wish there were more film festivals like that. So I really admire and respect what they've been able to do there in KL and PJ.
Mm-hmm. Untouchable, The Children of God, will be screened during the 2014 Freedom Film Festival at the Cabaret Theatre, PJ Live Arts, on September 11th, 7:30 p.m. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.